Thank you, Frank. My name is Keith Lewis. I'm an alcoholic. And next time I'm going to bring my left-handed clubs, Frank. I want to thank Fred and the committee for inviting me to be here. It's really a pleasure and a privilege to be here. It always is. I too want to thank the speakers who preceded me. I would like to have gotten up early and packed and left. There were just some wonderful, wonderful talks. I hadn't heard Larry before and just loved it. And I have heard Dennis and Ray, my two fellow North Carolinians. That's with an F. And Nancy, who I love very much. She's a little weird, but I really like her. And Clancy, who I truly love. I really love Clancy. And I also happen to like him, and I happen to enjoy him and everything. But I really love him, much like I love Clarence Snyder and Chuck Chamberlain and Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob Smith and people like that, because those are people, most of whom I'd never known or met, but who have defined Alcoholics Anonymous. And for that, I am very, very grateful and made it a better place. Last night after Clancy's talk, I had my talk all figured out. I was laying in a tub and I was absolutely brilliant. But this morning, I have no idea what I'm going to say. I'd like to tell you that I'm a member of the Carolina Beach Curie Beach Group, and I bring you their greetings. I also bring you the greetings of my lovely wife, Julia, who was going to come with me but got another job and so didn't want to schedule the time away. But I talked to her, and she asked that I give you her best. And I'd also like to say that by the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not found it necessary, nor have I taken a drink of alcohol or anything else since May the 13th, 1973, and for that I am entirely grateful. That's a miracle. That wasn't supposed to happen. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 29 years old and entirely spent. My story isn't any different than any of the other stories you heard. I grew up in a family. I took a drink. I died spiritually. I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you all have revived me. And that's sort of the story. I was born in a small town in Ohio. Tell everybody that I have 10 brothers and sisters. I'm Irish, and I won't tell you what church I go to. You're going to have to guess. But give you a hint, it has something to do with bingo, but I'm not going to say anymore. Okay? And at a very young age, I discovered I was afraid, and I had good reason to be afraid. There were a lot of things about my life that other people didn't have to deal with. I lived in constant terror of that thing that was under my bed. At night, when the lights were out, I'd press my little ear against a mattress and I could hear it moving around down there. And I knew what it was there for. It was waiting for me to dangle my little legs over the side of the bed. Nice history. And I knew that. And I also knew that I couldn't talk about it. I don't know why, but somewhere along the line I got the message that I couldn't talk about the things I was afraid of. And I learned what I think is my first bad lesson in the spiritual life. I learned that if you're afraid of something, you're supposed to be quiet about it. And you're supposed to somehow get brave. A fascinating way to approach life, to be brave about the things you're afraid of. And that's crazy. You know, it's absolutely crazy. But I don't know where I heard it. I don't know. Maybe I even thought it up. But it was one of my many old ideas. And you know, it's amazing what those ideas will do for you. I was living in North Carolina, and I bought a little house on the ocean. And my ex-wife called me up and said, the kids tell me that you bought a little house on the ocean. And I said, yes. And she said, well, I'm really surprised the way you hate the ocean and all. And I thought, I don't hate the ocean. Wonder where she got that idea. Then I remembered that what I have is a terrible fear of height. And we lived in Washington, D.C., and we drove to the beach once. And to get to the beach from Washington, D.C., you have to go over a bridge called the Bay Bridge. And it's 150 miles high, and it's 200 miles long. And they make you stop in the middle. And I was terrified. I was on that bridge, and I thought I was going to throw up. And I began to go blank, you know, and I began to see those little things in front of my eyes that happen when you're in high anxiety. And everything, I was sweating, and I was gripping the steering wheel and everything. I finally got across the bridge. And I drank all week thinking about coming back across the bridge. So instead of telling the woman I was married to I was afraid of height, I told her I didn't like the ocean. You know, and that's an example of what this sickness will do for you. You know, I like to talk about my first drink. I think it's important. It's hard to be an alcoholic if you don't have your first drink. Now, there are a few around, I suspect, that haven't, but most of us had our first drink, and I had it at home. I was 5 years old, and I didn't go out much. And I was with my brother, Dumb Denny, he's four, and my father. He was watching us. My mother was out. She was at the bingo or having a baby or something. And there was rarely alcohol around our house because Dad rarely drank, and Mom didn't drink at all because both Mom and Dad had parents who probably could have been diagnosed as having a drinking problem. So their idea about how to deal with that was to never let us see drinking. But, I don't know, some special event or something, my father had a few beers in the refrigerator, and I guess he thought it might be kind of funny. So he got a beer for me and one for Dumb Denny and one for himself. And then we drank our beers. And we were playing bug or some kind of game and on the kitchen table. And it didn't do anything to me. I was fine. But old Denny. Denny slid down under the table. And he began to roll around. And he was singing Mary Had a Little Lamb and other drinking songs. And Dad kind of panicked and... You know, and he wrestled Denny to the ground. He got his clothes off, and he put his jammies on him and everything, and he took him up and put him in bed, and I got ready for bed, and Denny and I shared a room. Hell, we all shared a room. And he was laughing and singing, and Dad says, don't tell your mother about this, and I'll take you to the movies. And I thought, well, that's a pretty good deal. I can keep my mouth shut. But Den wasn't hearing it. He was laughing and carrying on. And I never forget this. Old Den stood up in his little crib, and he urinated on the floor. You know? And I remember watching this thinking, you know, there's a kid who's powerless over alcohol and whose life has become unmanageable. And you know, the strangest thing happened to Denny. We're not very proud of this, but the truth is the truth. And I have to tell you the truth. Denny never quite made it. You know, he grew up and he did strange things. I'll give you some examples. Denny went to one university. And he graduated in 4 years. He had one major. He went to one graduate school. First in his class, graduated. You know, looked around, they offered him like 8 jobs. He took one. He's a senior vice president in a large international corporation. But you know, the strangest thing of all was Denny married one woman. Now, here's a guy who had the world in the palm of his hand when he was 4 years old, and he just let it slip through his fingers, you know? He was a natural. He was just a natural. I mean, he made it look easy. And I had to work at this thing. I was 23 years old before I urinated on the bedroom floor for the first time. You know, I was kind of new in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was brought... to what I believe is the first principle in the spiritual life. And I tell you how it happened. I hung around with a group of guys who were all sort of young. I was 29 years old when I got sober. And, you know, 22 years ago, there weren't a lot of people in Washington, D.C. younger than me who were sober. But there were, you know, a handful of us. And we all sort of hung around together. And we kind of had the problem of the month club. You know, we'd come up with the problem of the month and we'd discuss it and discuss it and discuss it. We didn't yet know that you needed to just pray about it and let it go, but we thought you could talk problems to death. A lot of the guys I sponsor think you can talk problems to death. But at any rate, they used to send me to old-timers to get the answers. Now, you got to look at some old-timers today. Nancy will be an old-timer pretty soon, but Clancy and some of those other people were old-timers. And I'd like to warn you to stay away from old-timers if you're kind of new. I tell you, they're not a well bunch of people. They're really not. They'll tell you that they come to meetings because they need to, but that's just not true. That's a lie. The reason they come to meetings is the only enjoyment they get out of life anymore is watching people like you and me suffer. And it's true. It's true. And if you don't believe me, go up to one of them after the meeting and tell them a problem you're having. The first thing they do is laugh. You know? And if you really want to make their day, tell them a sexual problem. They love sexual problems, you know. They're not having sex anymore, and they don't want you to have it either, so. No. Anyway, I used to go to this old-timer, and finally he just got tired of me showing up with these problems, and he said, "Keith, I want you to do something for me." I said, "Well, anything. I'm honest, willing, and open-minded." And he said, "I want you to borrow lipstick from one of the girls in the program." And he said, "I want you to go and write on the mirror, 'Keith, you're wrong.'" And I said, "Well, you see, I can't do that because, you see, my problem is I have a poor self-image and I need to be affirmed." Don't ever talk that way to an old-timer. They never read any of those books. And I said, all right. So I got some lipstick and I went and I wrote on my mirror, "Keith, you were wrong." And I had a normal night. I was sober about 60 days. Remember 60 days? Well, you know, I lay down at night and closed my eyes and my mind woke up for the first time that day. And it took off, you know. And it was talking to me. It was saying, "You're never going to make it. They're going to find out you're a phony. You're going to be alone the rest of your life. What difference does it make? You're impotent." Just all the good stuff. And it talked to me. And I toss and toss and turn and toss and turn. And I finally drift off to sleep. And then the leg cramps. Remember the leg cramps? Oh, I'd be jumping beside my bed. I'd wake up jumping up and down on the floor beside my bed howling. And then 15 minutes before the alarm went off, I go sound asleep. And it would take like 3 clocks to wake me up. And I'd get up, and depression was waiting for me, and it'd jump on me, and my mind was still going strong. And I went out in the kitchen to make some coffee, and saying, "You're going to go to work today, and they're going to find out you don't know how to do your job, and you're going to get fired. What difference does it make? You're hopelessly in debt," and the usual stuff. And I started the coffee, and I just wanted to cry, you know. And I went in the bathroom. I looked on a mirror. It said, "Keith, you're wrong." I said, "Well, thank God, because if I'm right, I'm in a hell of a lot of trouble." So if you're kind of new, the basic spiritual principle is being wrong. Being wrong. And yet, you know, like Clancy was saying, we'd rather be anything than wrong. You know, because to be wrong is to suffer public humiliation. And I come from a family of people who can't be wrong. It's an amazing phenomenon. Nothing ever gets settled. My ex-wife told me one time, just before she threw me out, I had my bags packed and I'm headed down the steps, and she said, "One more thing. This is just a suggestion, like the rest of the program, but if your wife's throwing you out and you're headed down the steps, and she says just one more thing, don't wait around. She's probably not going to say it's impossible to replace you as a lover or something like that. She said, "One more thing." She said, "All those times that that I stopped arguing with you, it wasn't because I think you were right, because you were wrong." I said, "Oh, no. The cruelest cut of all was to be wrong. And it's just somehow, if I was wrong, I was nobody." And yet I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they told me that if I weren't wrong and willing to be wrong, I'd spend the rest of my life suffering in the same sort of insanity I've been suffering in. And so the basic spiritual principle for me was being wrong. And I must tell you, it's the best news that I've ever received. Because I have been wrong about virtually everything. Virtually everything. And that's what it means to me to have old ideas. And I went to a Catholic school, and we had a little nun was our librarian. Her name was Sister Victoria. I hadn't talked about Sister Victoria in a while, but Sister Victoria was a neat little old lady, but weird, you know, one of those weird religious people. And she would run around saying weird things like, every boy is a prince and every girl is a princess because we have a father who's a king. And so we'd get behind her back and say, "Princess Mary and Prince Keith," and, you know, we'd ridicule her and everything. And she was a librarian, and we used to serve detention in the library. And I was what, if we'd had any money, which we didn't have, or insurance, I would have been diagnosed as an acting out adolescent. But we were poor, so I was just a punk. And so I spent a lot of time with Sister Victoria, and she used to put me behind a magazine rack because she said, "Though you're a prince, you are contagious." And for detention, we had to make rosary beads. You know, those are things that the Catholics pray on. And in each decade there are 10 beads, and there are 5 of these decades in each rosary. And so we get pliers and beads and things, and I got pretty good at this. And they'd take the rosary beads, and they'd send them to the missions all over the world. And mine were different. I used to make them with 11 beads in all the decades. And you know, after a few years with Sister Victoria, I had hundreds and hundreds of mutant rosary beads all over the world. And you know, just before I graduated from high school, she never caught on. You know, spiritual people are often dumb people. And she never caught on. And so finally I figured out, I'm going to fill her in. You can't let stuff like this go unnoticed. I mean, that was too good. And so I said to her, "Sister, you know what I've been doing for the last few years?" And she said, "Yes, I do, you sly little prince." She said, "You've been putting extra beads in all the decades of the rosary." And she said, "And I know why you've been doing it." And I remember thinking, "God, I hope she tells me, because I haven't the foggiest idea why I do these things." She said, "Because you're going to pray, people all over the world are going to pray extra prayers, and God's going to give you all the credit." Don't you just hate people like that? And you know, she took both of my hands in her hands. She was truly a woman filled with joy. I don't know how happy she was, but I know she was a woman filled with joy. And I know why now. I didn't know then. I used to think it was because she was weird or peculiar. We'd sit in this tiny little library. And I mean, it's a tiny. I've been back there recently. And it's a tiny little room with old books in it and everything. And she would stroll around this place like it was a Library of Congress. And I know why now. Because she was in the middle of God's will. And she knew that. She knew that secret. That she was exactly who she was, where she was supposed to be, doing what God would have her do. And she took both of my hands and she looked me in the eyes and she said, "You know, when I first met you, I knew you were a special, special child of God." And she said, "One day you're going to go all over the world telling God's children how much he loves them." It terrified me. Absolutely terrified me. I was a kid born with a horrible speech impediment and nobody could understand anything I said. And she took a medal, St. Jude, and put it on her long, used to wear these long rosary beads to bang them against the desk when you're taking tests. And she put this medal on these beads. And St. Jude is a patron saint of lost causes. And she said, "Every time I get to St. Jude's medal, I say a special prayer for you." And you know, I didn't put it all together, but you know, when I was a younger man, about 12, I guess, I had an operation. And my grandmother was a great lover of St. Jude. And before they took me into surgery, she pinned a little St. Jude medal on me. And she hid it because she knew it must be against the law. But she hid it on my whatever I was wearing, and they took me into surgery. And while I was in surgery, they clamped my tongue improperly or something and tore it. And so they sewed it back up. And then they didn't worry about lawsuits, so they said to my parents, "We're really sorry we tore your son's tongue, but we sewed it back up." And, you know, when I came out of it, I could speak fairly well. I still had to concentrate and still do have to concentrate when I speak to form words. But it's been those sorts of patterns throughout my life. But you see, I was spiritually ill. And what that means is that I can't see the working of God in my life. That's what being spiritually ill means to me. It's like, as a person who's spiritually ill, I could be surrounded by love. And all I could do is find what was wrong. And I couldn't experience it. And I remember my mother said to me one time, "We could have loved you better." And I could honestly say to her, it wouldn't have made any difference. It wouldn't have made any difference. Because I couldn't experience the love that was there. That's what being spiritually ill is all about. And I can't imagine learning to experience love any place other than Alcoholics Anonymous. Because for me, this is where it happened. I was one of those people that when I was drinking, I'd sometimes wake up in the middle of the night and I couldn't go back to sleep and I'd be haunted. And I'd look over and I was married to this woman and I felt like I was in bed with somebody else's wife. And then I got up and I'd walk around and I'd go in the bedroom and little Kelly and little Kimberly were just infants and they'd been in our little cribs and sometimes I just touched their little heads. And I knew they couldn't be mine because nothing that good could come from me. And that's what being spiritually ill is all about. It's being so filled and racked with fears that I had to act brave all the time, and I had to be obnoxious, and I had to be overbearing, and most of all, I had to be right. That's what being spiritually ill is all about. I'm sponsoring a wonderful guy. I won't tell you his name, but he's decided he's been called to preach. And I really think that's wonderful. I really do. And I told him, I said, you know, I think it's great you've been called to preach. But usually when you're sober about 5 weeks, you're often called to something different every day. And and I said, what you've had is an AA spiritual awakening. You can tell an AA spiritual awakening because it happens at 11:45 and you have to call your sponsor by about 12:30 at night and to share it with him. And then he reverses the charges because he doesn't have a telephone. And so I said to him, what happens if one of your flock gets into trouble and they can't call you? And he shops at the local dumpster. And he's really deciding now whether he's going to take my advice or not. It's one of those sorts of things, you know. But I told him that if God's calling him to preach, he'll probably call him a year from now. And it'll be all right to do. But I know exactly how he feels because I know how desperate he is about making up for what he's done with his life. And I really do understand that. I know the demons that live there and the ones that somewhere in the middle of the night will wake you up if you are lucky enough to get to sleep to remind you of what you really are. You know, you're nothing like those people treat you, though you are. You know, you go to AA and they hug you and they shake your hand and they tell you you're wonderful. But we know the real truth. And I know those demons. Those demons plagued me for years. They plagued me right up until the ninth step. And then they left me alone. They moved on to guys like the guy I'm sponsoring to plague him. Because once you do those first nine steps, they don't have much of a hold on you. Oh, they'll mess with you at bad times and push you around a little bit or something like that. But, you know, you talk to your sponsor, go find a new guy or go to a few meetings, and then they're gone again. But you know, in the beginning, it's amazing to me that any of us... What, did I offend somebody? My God, everybody's leaving. Clancy, are you still back there? Can you stop this? You get to the spiritual part, all the macho men leave. You ever notice that? But, you know, those demons were always with me. They were just always there. And I ended up, I got to Alcoholics Anonymous the way most of us do, after the last drink I could possibly take and live. And there's no question in my mind about that. And it was May the 13th, 1973. And I made that phone call, and I got some help from some people, and I ended up in the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll never forget it. It was on the second step, and I didn't know anything about what... They said you have to take the steps, And, you know, the meeting I went to was on the ground floor, and I'm looking around for these steps that you have to take. And, you know, we really have a language all our own. And then they said, well, the second step, and then they said what it was. And so then I began to understand a little bit. But when they opened the meeting, they opened it with the thing they called the preamble. And one of the words in that preamble just washed over me like a warm tide. And that word was fellowship. It said a fellowship of men and women. And that was one of those warm, warm words that impressed me deeply because fellowship was something I knew nothing about. I had been alone or isolated my whole life. I was alone with all the bad things. I could share a few of the good things that happened, but they didn't last for very, very long. But fellowship was one of those magic words that washed over me. And then the other thing I remember from that meeting was there was a man who stood at the door who greeted me. And he... shook my hand, and he looked me in the eye. And I think hugging's nice, but I love handshakes because people look each other in the eye when they shake hands. And he shook my hand, and he said, you know, son, you keep... You know, he said to me, you're new. And my thought, first thought was, my God, he's psychic. You know? And then he said, you keep coming here. You never have to drink again. And I thought, that's not possible. You don't know. You don't understand. I tried this not drinking stuff. I had the same experience Clancy did. I was mad. When I didn't drink, I was absolutely mad. I punched my wife out in a blackout once, and I swore to her I wouldn't drink again. And 6 weeks later, she laid my tuxedo out and arranged for us to go to the theater and enter the Red Coach Inn so that I could drink again. Because when I didn't drink, we were both insane. So I knew I couldn't not drink. I knew that that was virtually impossible. The other thing that happened to me was they set me down next to an old woman. Must have been like Kathy. She was patting me. I never figured out what was going on there, but she kept patting me and patting me. Halfway through the meeting, she looked at me and she smiled and she said, "You know, son, you keep coming here, you never have to be alone again." And I knew they didn't know me because I had to be alone. I lived essentially alone. I was never comfortable unless I was by myself and alone. And so they didn't know me. I knew they didn't know me. But I didn't have any place else to go. And I began to be confronted with those things that later I were told were part of the spiritual illness. Yeah, a horrible hatred for anybody who was successful or wealthy. I grew up in what would really pass for poverty. I mean, really, it would really pass for poverty. If you didn't know any better, you'd think we were poor. Now, I happen to know now we were fabulously wealthy because I had a father who loved me every day and came home from work every day and played with me if I'd let him. And I had a mother who the day never went by that she didn't hug me and kiss me and tell me she loved me. And my mother never finished high school, and she raised 11 of her own children and 3 or 4 other kids who didn't have any place to go. And she read a book a day. Amazing woman, read a book a day. She's still the smartest person I know. And I've worked in some of the finest universities in the country, all around. She's the smartest woman I know. She knows more stuff than anybody I've ever met. And because she helped me learn to speak, and a couple other people had to go through all these drills, and we'd have to have a word a week, and we'd have to use that word 3 or 4 times. And so we'd have to memorize it, and then we'd have to memorize the definition, and we'd have to use it. We'd sit around the kitchen table, and before we could eat or something, we'd have to tell her what the word was and everything, and we'd have to use it. And I remember once that one word was gaggle. She said, "What's your word this week, son?" And I said, "It's gaggle, Mom." And she said, "What does it mean?" I said, "Well, it's like a whole flock." And she said, "Well, could you use it?" And I said, "Yes, I live in a gaggle of idiots." She said, "That was a very precise use of the word, son." Mom went back after we all got out of school. Mom went back and finished her high school, got her high school diploma, and took her college entrance boards and scored higher than all of us. And she said, "Why not? I've been through high school 15 times." And she had been. Dad was one of those silent guys. And, you know, the reason I got into the trouble that I got into was Dad never told me he loved me. Never told me he loved me. That and Mother had a square nipple were my two most serious problems when I got here. But just never told me he loved me. I tell you, that'll stab you deeply, boy. And you know, you can sit on a bar stool some years later and tell people that. They'll cry and buy you drinks and do all sorts of things. The problem, of course, was that the receiver was broken. Dad told me he loved me every day. He went to work every day. He came home every day. He spent time with us every day. He taught me everything a kid who needed to know where I grew up. Never crawl under the train. If you're going to get through the train, be careful, because when a train starts, it jerks, you know, knock you under the wheels and run you over. Now, you live next to a railroad track. That in a ball field's on the other side of the railroad track. That's important stuff to know. And I remember we'd go play ball, old dumb Denny and Dad and I'd go play ball, and we'd be coming back, and they had a little diner next to the steel mill. It was a train coach diner. They put 2 train cars together and make a diner out of it, and we'd say, "Dad, can we go and have a pop?" And I always drank orange, and Dan always drank grape, and Dad always drank root beer. And he'd say, "Well, let me think about it." And he'd drop back, and I'd see him. He'd be looking in his pocket. And if he had 18 cents, we'd go have a pop. And if he only had 12 cents, he'd say something like, "Well, you know, I'm not very thirsty. Why don't you and Denny have one, and I'll just take a drink of yours?" Then there were days when he didn't have anything. And he'd say, "Your mom looked awfully lonely. why don't we go home and have some, maybe have some Kool-Aid or something and spend some time with her. But you know, he never told me he loved me. Man who never drove an automobile till the last kid who wanted to go to college went. But he never told me he loved me. What a self-centered puke I was. Now, what I was, of course, was spiritually blind and spiritually deaf. I was surrounded by love, and I couldn't depict it. You know, the eighth step, it's true, the eighth step says most people treat us the way we demanded they treat us. I ran away from home when I was 17 years old, and the way I did that was I joined the Marine Corps. I was perfect for it. I was 5 feet 1 inches tall, and I weighed 113 pounds. And I was a born killer. And and then after the Marine Corps, which I got out of because of my alcoholism, I did very well. I loved it. I really did. The Marine Corps made perfect sense to me. They told me for the first time in my life I knew exactly what I was supposed to do and when I was supposed to do it and how it was supposed to be done. And I won Dress Blues Award off of Paris Island, an Outstanding Man's Award, and I got all sorts of things, meritorious promotions. And at the very end, I was offered a commission and an opportunity to go to Quantico, to Officer's Candidate School. I was the youngest NCO in the Marine Corps at one time, and I would have been the youngest officer in the Marine Corps. But I got out because, you see, the spiritual illness led me to something which was the pattern of my existence, and that is that I began to violate the principles of this program, the Marine Corps, and then I began to blame the Marine Corps for what was happening to me. I ended up violating virtually every principle associated with the United States Marine Corps. I drank on duty. I led a patrol in a combat zone in a blackout. I did everything you could do. And then I blamed the Marine Corps for what had happened to me, and I got out. And I did the same thing with marriage. I violated virtually every principle associated with being married, and I blamed my wife for what happened to me, and I got out. And that's called spiritual illness. And I don't want that to happen in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't want to violate the principles associated with this wonderful program. Because if I get out, I got no place else to go. This is the last stop for people like me. You know, I came to AA desperate. And somewhere around 2 weeks, I decided that I would do whatever you told me to do. And that isn't like me. But I desperately wanted to be like you. I had never been so impressed by anybody in my life as I was by you. And I had a few old ideas, and one of them, as I mentioned, was that I hated people who were successful and wealthy. One of the horrible things of growing up in poverty is that parents who love you very much have got to find a reason for why things are the way they are. And the only reason we could come up with was anybody who had anything did something bad to get it. So I had this old idea that if I was ever to be successful, I'd have to be bad. I'd have to cheat and steal and walk on people to be successful. And on the one hand, I desperately wanted to be successful because I'm loaded with greed. And on the other hand, I didn't want to be a bad person. And my sponsor, his name was Dan at the time, told me to show up at the Fox Hall group in Washington one time. And it was at this beautiful cathedral, Gothic old brick building, beautiful thing. But most of all, a bunch of rich people went there. You know, blue-haired old ladies who made stuffed mushroom caps and Swedish meatballs. And I heard all about them. They drank their coffee out of a cup and saucer. And it wasn't a real AA group. So my sponsor, Dan, said, I want you to go over there. There's a guy speaking over there. I want you to hear him. And I said, I don't go to that meeting. And he said, oh, why, pray tell? I said, well, I don't like those kind of people. He said, what kind of people? Alcoholics? I said, no, those snobs. And he said, have you ever been there? And I said, no. He said, and how the hell do you know what kind of people were over there? He said, be there, or I'll break your knee. We had a deal. If I did what he said, he wouldn't break my knee. So I showed up, but I tell you, I found the rattiest clothes I could find, and I took my own styrofoam cup. I mean, I'll go so far, but I do have some pride, you know. And I'm going through the line, and it was a man named Philip R., Roland R., sorry. Roland was a professor of romantic poetry at Georgetown University, a wonderful man. He had a handlebar mustache and handlebar eyebrows. And he leaned across the counter and he said, how do you find our meeting? And I said, the Swedish meatballs suck. And Dan smacked me in the back of the head and said, get through the line. And so I spent a perfectly miserable hour listening to H.M. and Sandy B. speak. And I just hated every minute of it. I started to get up to get coffee, and Dan said to me, are you having a heart attack? And I said, no. And he said, do you have diarrhea? And I said, no. He said, then sit down and pay attention. And I don't believe I've gotten up and walked out of a meeting since. He said, we know you have no respect for yourself, but you can start by showing a little for somebody else. And when the meeting was over, he said, come on, we're going to go outside and talk. And we went outside, and he said, tell me, Keith, he said, do you want to be a failure the rest of your life? And I said, no. And he said, well, you've established a living pattern that'll guarantee that. He said, somewhere along the line, you got the idea that people who were happy and successful and made something or had something weren't any good. And he said, you got a decision now. You either got to decide that that's true and blow it for the rest of your life, which is what I did. I worked hard, and I'd be advanced, and they'd always move me along, and they'd give me raises and stuff, and then I'd have to do something really stupid to ruin it. And he said, you can decide that you're wrong about things, and you can be different. And I decided I was going to be wrong about things. And I went to that meeting, and I found out that some of the people there were successful, some weren't. Some were wealthy, some weren't. They were like normal drunk people. Normal member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I found out that I was wrong. You know, I worked those steps, and I got to that eighth and ninth step, and I'd like to spend just a few minutes talking about that. The eighth and ninth step is the one that I bump into a lot of folks who are sober 5 or 6, 7, 8, 9 years, and they ask me to sponsor them. New people don't like me to sponsor very much. They think I'm a Nazi or something, and I'm really not. But people have been around a little while often ask me to sponsor them, and I find that invariably they've stopped at the fifth step. And they get very good at inventorying. I got very good at inventorying. They had to use a gun to get me to take my first fourth step. But once I took it, I got real good at it, you know. And I'd always be contemplating my navel. I'd say, well, you know, how does this make me feel? I was so insufferable that a group got together at one group in D.C., and they got me after the meeting, a bunch of old-timers, sick bunch. And they said to me, said, Keith, we had a business meeting last week, and we took a vote, and the vote was 11 to nothing, that we don't give a damn how you feel. I said, aren't I supposed to share my feelings? And they said, when you share your feelings, Keith, you're pathetic. We want to see what you're doing. We don't care how you feel. We could care less how you feel. If you don't like the way you feel, drink. We want to see what you're going to do. Yes, things have really changed along those lines. I know that we used to have meetings where we had a topic, and a topic would be a principle, like resentment. And what do we do about resentment? Or what do we do about this? What do we do about that? Now, a lot of meetings I go to, they'll say, does anybody here have a problem? And I want to jump up and say, hell yes, we have a problem. That's why we're at the meeting, you know. I go to one group, honestly, this is the truth. They'll say, we normally read the big book unless someone has a problem. We'll talk about that, you know. So then somebody brings up a problem. Mother had a square nipple. And, you know, 50 untrained psychiatrists will analyze that problem, you know, and it's a marvelous thing. But they were nasty to me. They weren't interested in how I felt about things. They didn't really care how I was doing. They just wanted to know, you got anything to drink? No, you're fine. But I feel like I'm dying. Well, you're not dying. And then, you know, at the very end of the meeting, they'd say something like, anybody here have something they need to say? And I'd put my hand up. They'd say, what is it now, Keith? I'd say, I can't sleep. And then they'd take turns. You know, somebody would say, nobody ever died from not sleeping. You know, they'd take turns. So one night I just screamed, no, but people died from saying nobody ever died from not sleeping. I mean, you know. I got to my eighth step, and I began to run into some things. I ran into a name on there called Dumb Denny. And I'd been giving Denny a hard way to go. I mean, it's hard to have a brother like Denny, you know, who does everything once, you know, and just goes up the ladder. You know, there goes Denny up the ladder. Where's Keith? God knows. So I began this little thing called detraction, you know, character assassination. And whenever I had a chance to say something negative about Denny, I'd take it. You know, he couldn't say much. Oh, Denny's got an extra zit. But every chance I got, I'd say something negative about him. And then I came to that name, and I prayed about it, and I talked to my sponsor about it, and I went up the road. I was living in Washington, and at that time Denny was living in New Jersey, and I hunted Denny up. And, you know, I got up there, and through a series of events, we never got together, so I drove back, because I knew that it wasn't right. And I prayed a little bit more, and I drove back to see Denny. And we had a talk, and I never forget it as long as I lived. His wonderful wife, Jan, knew that this was different, and she excused herself and went to bed. And I began to tell Denny something about my alcoholism and everything. And I said, the reason I'm here is because I owe you an amends. He said, what on earth for? And I told him, I said, you know, I've so envied you and your success and the way you've lived and the way you've made good decisions. I said, any chance I've had, I've detracted. I said, now in the last 6 months, I've done just the opposite. And any chance I have to say something good about you, I've said it. And I said, and it's true and I mean it. And I stand ready to do anything else I can to right our relationship. And he started to laugh, and he said, you know, if you owe me an amend, then I owe you an amend. He said, all my life, I've envied you. He said, I've always been so afraid to make a change that whenever I started to do something, I never felt free to do anything else. And he said, you were never like that. He said, you were always brave and free. He said, and you never gave a shit about anything. He said, if things weren't going well for you in one country, you go to another country. He said, you've been in more universities than I can keep up with. He said, you're one of the most traveled men I've ever known in my life. And he said, I've always wanted to be just like you. And I've discovered that we weren't good and bad. We were just different. We were different people. And we love our differences. You know, funny things happen. Every time he gets a promotion, he'll wait in his office till I get home. He'll call me up. And it's before he tells his wife or anybody. And Julie will say, Den called, and he says he's in his office, and so I'll call him, and he'd say, you know, I was offered a promotion, I was offered a vice presidency or a senior vice presidency. He said, I don't know whether to take it or not. He said, I've gone a lot further than I ever thought I could. He said, you know, I'm just a poor kid from the Ohio Valley. He said, I'm in the wrong place. We talk about it. He said, what would your friends say about this? And I try to remember what you told me, and I tell him. We become dear, dear friends. And, you know, I got to that thing, Dad. Boy, that's a hard one. That was a hard one for me, Dad. And I'd drive from Washington to Ohio to make amends to Dad. And I'd get around him, and we'd have a cup of coffee, and about a half an hour later, I was absolutely in a rage. And I'd get in my car, and I'd go drive back to Washington. That happened 3 times. I go to my sponsor, I'd say, it's not going to work. It doesn't work. It doesn't work with that man. He's impossible. He's like a stone wall. And my sponsor would say, it will work. You haven't quite prayed enough. He said, I'll bet you're real close. He said, you're probably within yards. I said, all right, I'll pray some more. So I'd pray some more. And then finally, Mom and Dad moved down to North Carolina. I had a little house down there, and they went down and lived it on the ocean for a while. Dad had never seen the ocean. He's just amazed by it. He spent 6 years just looking at it, walking by it, reading about it and things. But I went down there, and I was an officer in a hospital corporation at this time and everything, and I really needed to talk to Dad. And I went down, and I said, you know, Dad, I'm just miserable doing what I'm doing. I said, I'm afraid that to stop doing what I'm doing, even though I'm miserable, because then I might not be a success. And I'm told I'm a success. And he just laughed. And he said, you're a success when you're doing what God wants you to do. He said, I always knew that God wanted me to be a machinist, and he wanted me to be a mechanic. But most of all, he wanted me to come home to my wife and children. He said, that's what God wanted me to do. And he said, you're already more successful than I've ever been, which of course is a lie. I mean, that's absolutely untrue. But he said, so I wouldn't presume to tell you. He said, but what I do know is that since you've been hanging around with those people, you haven't made a bad decision. Isn't that amazing? And then he told me a story, which I'll never forget. He said, remember when you went to work for the very first time? You were 12 years old. I said, oh yeah, Dad, I got the job setting pins in a bowling alley. The Jim Lemoine's bowling alley in Bridgeport. He said, yeah. And he said, remember the first day you went to work? And I said, well, I don't think so. And he said, we went to lunch. We went to Louis's hot dog stand. And I said, oh yeah, yeah. He said, do you remember what you ate? And I said, no, I don't. I probably had a hot dog. He said, yeah, you had a hot dog with ketchup and onions. And he said, do you remember what you drank? And I said, well, probably an orange pop. That's what I always drank. He said, no, you had a root beer. He said, I drank root beer, and I think you thought men who work drank root beer. He said, then I talked to you, and he said, I told you what it was like to go to work. And he said, I explained to you about you do a good day's job for a good day's wage, and you owe your boss respect, and he owes you respect. He said, then I walked you down to the bus. And he said, you got on the bus. I had to take a bus to the next town. And I said to you, son, do you want me to go with you on the first day? And you said to me, no thanks, Dad, I can do it myself. And he said, I watched my 12-year-old little boy. He said, you were so puny and skinny. He said, I watched you get on the bus. And he said, I watched the bus till it was out of sight. And you never looked back. And he said, from that day on, I never felt I had the right to ever tell you anything. What the book says is true. People treat me the way I force them to treat me. And he said, all your brothers and sisters let me help them go to school, and you never let me help you. You did everything yourself. And he said, I have never felt that I've been your father, and I haven't felt as though I've done a very good job. And I knew why I owed him an amends. Because I wouldn't let him do what he was put on earth to do, and that was to be a good father. I ran into a little name called Sister Victoria. And I realized my attitude about Sister Victoria was the attitude I had about all religious or spiritual people. I was frightened of them, so of course I hated them. And I went down to a retreat center to find someone who was religious and spiritual. And I ran into an old man who was down there, and by this time I had gotten a degree in theology and philosophy and a lot of things, and I was looking for this young theologian down there because I was going to make the amends with him because he would understand the significance of this deeply humble act I was about to perform. And I couldn't find him. He wasn't there, he wasn't around, or he was busy. And but I kept seeing this old man sitting in his room reading his breviary and rocking in a rocking chair. And I went in and I said, Father, could I have a few moments of your time? He said, of course, son, sit down. And so I sat in a rocking chair across from him, and we rocked and talked. And I told him why I was there, and I told him about what I'd done and where I'd been and some of the horrible, blasphemous things I had done and the really crude jokes that I told about people like him and everything. And I got about halfway through, and he stopped me. And he said, son, stop. And he pulled me up, and he put his arms around me. He began to pat me. And he said, you know, it's not you who owe me an amends, it's I who owe you an amends. He said, I've been a priest for 50 years, and he said, I have an illness which is going to allow me to go to my father. And he said, I was sitting here asking my higher power where I failed. Where have I failed in my service to you? Where have I failed in my ministry? And he said, now I know that too many times in those 50 years, I stayed with the 99 that I was comfortable with and who liked me and who agreed with me. And I didn't do what my higher power told me to do, and that is to go after the one that was lost. And he said, I'm sorry you had to be out there all alone. And I discovered that I was wrong about religious people. Religious people aren't people who do what's right. Religious people are people who want to do what's right, who do the best they can with what they have. And you know what that means? That means I can be a religious person. Because I really want to do the best I can with what I have. And I'll blow it. But that's okay. I'll come back and try again. So I don't have to hate religious people anymore. And I ran into this person called God. And I had I had confronted God once before in this process. I went to a man to do my fifth step, and he instructed me to do exactly what the fifth step said. And I said, "Well, that's why I'm here." He said, no. He said, "Do exactly what the fifth step said." And I was, you know, I was anxious, and I had written certain things in a way that was could be taken in different ways, which is a form of dishonesty and everything. And he said, "Go tell God and tell yourself, and then another human being, the exact nature of who wrongs." So I went home and I rewrote this thing, and I put my three-piece suit on, and I went to this little chapel, and I showed up, and I had my fourth step in my hand, and I said, "Remember me, Keith, I used to serve Mass a lot. I served a Mass nobody else wanted. Remember, 5:45, I'd be there, even if it was snowing." And you know, you can't be too careful. But, you know, I sat there, and to the best of my ability, I told my father exactly what I saw. Then I went home, and I sat in a chair in front of a full-length mirror, and I told myself the truth about me as I knew it. And, you know, then I could have told a bus driver. It didn't matter. I always thought that I was afraid of people, and I wasn't. I was afraid of God, and I was afraid of me. And I discovered that once I'm square with God and once I'm square with me, I can go anywhere and do anything. I can succeed. I can fail. Nothing matters anymore. True freedom. And then I confronted God in this ninth step, and I told him how sorry I was for all the blasphemy and all the things and all the ridiculing and all the. And I told him, I said, "But you know this. You made me, and you say I'm wonderfully made, so it must be true. But you know how afraid I've been. You know how spiritually ill I've been. Whenever I'm afraid of something, I ridicule it and I laugh at it." I said, "I'm going to try not to do that anymore. I'm going to try from this day on to be in your service any way, shape, or form I can. And I will never say no to a request if I think it's in your will." And you know, I'm being slowly relieved of a spiritual illness that's killed millions and millions and millions of us. As Clancy said last night, it'll kill 95% of the people who have it today. And I'm being slowly, slowly relieved of that. And I had a wonderful brother named Terry. And 2 years ago, last month, it was the day after my 20th AA birthday, Terry died. And the coroner's report will say, or death certificate will say cancer. But it really wasn't cancer, it was alcoholism. Terry died sober. Terry came to Alcoholics Anonymous 18 years before he died, and he had 90 days and two times. And for some reason, it never really happened for Terry, and I never understood why, and I just don't know those things, and those things really aren't my business. And Terry was the one person on my list that I couldn't make amends to, because whenever I'd go home, he'd leave town. And I remember I finally got to make amends to Terry, because my parents were having their 50th wedding anniversary, and Terry came, and he was drunk. And all the kids were there, and the children they raised who weren't their kids but were their spiritual kids were there. And people came from all over the country. It was a magnificent thing, and they renewed their vows and everything. And Terry came, and Terry was drunk. And my brothers and sisters came to me, because I'm in charge of drunk in our family now. And and they said, "What do we do with them?" And I said, "Let's love them." And they said, "But he's drunk." I said, "Of course he's drunk. He's an alcoholic. I mean, that's no revelation." I said, "But let me tell you something about being an alcoholic. It's harder for Terry to be here than all of us put together." It was amazing. It freed him up, and they just loved him. And he's in all the pictures. His head's a little lopsided or something. But he's in all the pictures, and I made amends to him. And from that time on, he never left town when I went home. And I heard he was sick, and I went home, and I just wanted to spend a little time with him. And I couldn't, because my family's all gathered around all the time, and he's in the hospital. And every time I go to see him, 100 people would show up. So finally, I told him, we went to Mass in the morning, and we went back, and I said, "Look, I'm going to get back to North Carolina. I have to leave early and get back." So I threw my stuff in the car, and I drove to the hospital. And Terry and I had a couple hours together. He had a million questions. He said to me, he said, "Can you talk to me about God?" And he said, "What's this rosary thing?" And I had an extra rosary, would you believe? And we talked about the brown scapular, which is a sacramental devotion thing for Catholics. And I mean, I've really gone back in a big way. I serve a Latin Mass, if you'd believe it, like I was a little altar boy again, except my knees creak along with the priest. But I was telling him all these things, and he just had a million questions, and we talked and everything. And before I left, I hugged him. I hugged him just for a minute. You know, when you're newly sober, as he was, you can't get real close to people. Remember how it was? You know, if somebody touched you, your skin began to crawl, you know. So I hugged him just for a minute, and he was frail by this time. And he'd had a hard life. He lived on the skids, and he lived in a basement of a dive, much like I had, and lived near a boiler to stay warm. And he collected aluminum cans, and he gave half of what he made to people who really needed it and things like that. But I hugged him, and I was reminded of a spiritual principle I learned when I was studying theology. And what I learned was there are two kinds of time. One time is what we call chronos, chronological time, and that's the time that goes by minutes and hours and days and weeks and months and years. And then there's kairos, which is God's time. And God's time is always now. It's always right now. And I hugged him, but I hugged him forever in God's time. It was an amazing experience. And just before I left, he said to me, "You know, I didn't leave town." And I laughed and I said, "I'm really glad." And he said, "Me too." And then he said to me, "I don't think I'll ever have to drink again." And I said, "You know, I don't think you will either. I don't think you will either." And you know, he didn't. He didn't. And he lived about 6 months. And my whole family got to love him the way they always wanted to. It was magnificent. Magnificent. My brother Larry, who was sober 2 or 3 weeks when Terry first got sick, is still sober and got a couple years now. But Larry would go up there. He'd think of something he wanted to tell me, get in the car and drive 13 hours or 12 hours to tell him something he wanted to tell me, get in the car and drive back. When you're new, you have that kind of energy, you know. It was just magnificent. I mean, it was absolutely magnificent. And I would have told you that there was no hope for a guy like Terry. And until I knew there was hope for a guy like me, there couldn't be hope for a guy like Terry. You've taught me everything I know. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart. Because you took all the stuff I knew before and you ferreted out what was wrong. And you always gave me what was right. I got one thing, and I don't want to embarrass him, but I have a dear friend here. His name is Jim. Jim, would you stand up? I hate to do this. Would you stand? Yeah. Thank you. I met Jim in Naples this year. Thanks. I met Jim in Naples this year. He nearly killed me with a golf ball, so we've been very close. it was really a wonderful thing. And I'm going to, I hope you don't mind, but Jim's battling an illness that all the experts say is going to take him. I happen to feel differently about this. Jim has received word Wednesday or Thursday of this week. He only wanted one thing. He wanted to carry our flag at the International. And Jim received word this week that he's going to carry our flag at the International. And I just admire and respect him so much. He's a man of service. And I want to grow up and be just like him. Thank you very much.